Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Giuseppe and I, well, I think many, most of you, all of you know us. So, could you just say a little, think about yourself?
Okay. This one is on. Okay. Hi, my name is Crystal Huff. And I am here from Boston and Beijing, sort of. And I co-chaired the World Science Fiction Convention in Helsinki. I worked on it for about 4.5 years. And I am a big fan of Ursula K. Le Guin and am excited to talk with you about Ursula today.
Okay, I'm not sure. Our reactions, as we've been briefly speaking yesterday, we all ended up choosing one book and rereading it.
Yeah.
That's what both of you, and for me, my immediate read was The Dispossessed. You have left Hand of Darkness here, and he's going to talk about his new discovery. I don't know, who...
Okay, per vincere l'imbarazzo di Salvatore, a me sarebbe piaciuto che cominciassero loro, perché loro sicuramente potranno darvi un quadro di Ursula Le Guin, mentre io mi soffermerò su un aspetto personale, ma che comunque che è quello del vero e proprio trauma che mi ha causato la lettura di questo romanzo, Left Hand of Darkness, La mano sinistra delle tenebre, quando l'ho letto nel 1971-72, poco dopo che era uscita l'edizione italiana. Quindi è una visione molto parziale la mia. Ecco perché io pensavo di lasciare a loro due, esperti, conoscitori e quel che più conta, entusiasti di questa grande scrittrice da poco scomparsa, il ruolo di aprire le danze, per così dire. Aprite voi le danze.
Maybe we should begin as Leguinians, and you're going to give us but you read, after all, you read Le Guin. In one of my personas, I'm a critic. I've written about Le Guin for both for science fiction venues and academic, but what I really would like to talk about is that at some point that would have been, I've tried to been trying to pinpoint the exact time, I can't remember if my emails have been lost, but at some point we started corresponding. That would have been 2002, 2003. I sent her an article, which was about Letter in the Darkness and Always Coming Home. And she appreciated the fact that I wasn't treating the future Native American people in Always Coming Home not as some sort of primitivist utopias. They have computers and they're, and so on. So that started it all. I would occasionally send her an article. I would write. She would read Italian. She read Italian. It was a very slow-paced but steady correspondent. Someone advised me, don't expect more than 3 emails a year. Okay, but I've been getting those. At some point, in some occasions, of course, the rhythm was steadier. I translated one of her pieces at some point, and that was a different kind of experience. Exchanging about, talking about the translation with someone who somehow knew both languages, and looking and usually finding together solutions for a lot of little strange things that just can't come across smoothly from English to Italian. A lot of stuff about character genders. The Paradise is Lost, a novella, Paradise is Lost, in a collection called Birthday of the World. Those were the steadier, the more crowded period. But she had email correspondence from all over the world. And I guess I was the Italian one. She needed one Italian. What did she talk about? Well, of course, we had common acquaintances. She had family who would come and spend probably most of the year in Italy, somewhere in Liguria, in the La Spezia region. So a little bit was about Italy. A little bit was about serious stuff, from politics to bad adaptations of Earthsea, and some of them were light stuff, cats, lots of cats.
Traditional use of the internet.
Maybe she invented that the cats were, and she was obviously competent at cats, knowledgeable. Common friends. I told her that one of her translators had been dedicated to the square in Turin. So she started hunting for equivalent places in the U.S. There is, in Sacramento, California, apparently, there is a neighborhood with all street names. Excitement for coming visit of a Spanish colleague, Rosa Montero, Spanish science fiction writer. She would convey is enthusiasm. That's what obviously, to my mind, is one of the main things that made her so important. That was her attitude, someone welcoming other people from faraway places. Or I read many memories of younger writers, younger fans, professionals, welcoming into a professional community. That's Okay, maybe we have a second round.
Yeah. So I think we should do a little bit of talking between ourselves as well. And I think maybe what you're demonstrating is that we represent a range of experiences of Ursula K. Le Guin. So people in the audience, how many of you have felt touched by Ursula K. Le Guin's work? Like, it has impacted your life, right? And how many here have actually corresponded with her personally, right? So she had a far greater impact even without personally, you know, communicating with many people. She did a lot of work to blog in ways that were useful to the science fiction writers community and to the science fiction readers community. And this was sort of a service of love that was separate from her fiction writing, because we have lots of fiction from Ursula that's been compiled in anthologies or individual novels, and what she has dozens and dozens of books, and those are just the fiction works. The blog is just like a service of information about being a writer or about suggestions for what to read that are sort of just, it's just a gift to even reread now that she's gone, and people who even didn't have a personal experience of her might be mourning her around the world and be able to read things that she wrote for free. There are people who are compiling a discussion of Ursula K. Le Guin's work in China next month. You know, she never visited China, that we know of anyway, but she touched lives there as well. So.
Well, and her essays were also very important. How many books of essays did she write? A lot, and there's a lot of uncollected stuff. I have one of the uncollected. It was obvious right at the beginning that I wasn't going to ask her for anything, essays, articles, whatever. That was evidently out of the picture, which means on one occasion I wrote a retrospective piece on Theodore Sturgeon and asked her if you could send us a brief thing. And she did very, very, very kindly. Let me add one thing that for me was very consistent with her fiction writing. She was very, very ironic and grinning, probably is the best word. Many people over the year, many of the Le Guin critics kept saying she's too serious, she's ponderous, she's preachy, magisterial, she wants to, she's didactic. No way. She's ironic. You're taking for too serious what she's actually, was actually mocking, and with a wink of her eye was always there.
Well, and that might be an interesting way to look at Left Hand of Darkness, where people have all sorts of interpretations of this book that was published in 1969, right? Mm-hmm. So before some of us were born. She reissued it and with a new introduction in, I think, the 1970s or 1980s. And even then, the introduction talked about how, you know, people took her work so seriously as an idea that, you know, this was her projection for the future. And this was maybe one glimmer in the eye of a possible future. She was not saying this is what's going to happen. And she doesn't think that science fiction necessarily prescribes what will happen. She just had an idea and took it to a logical extreme and made what she thought was a compelling story out of it. And so some of the things that I too struggle with in Left Hand of Darkness, as someone whose my pronouns in English are she or they, and I look at this book, and she had the option of describing the characters who lived in this story, who were in periods of non-binary genderness, who did not describe themselves as man or woman. She had the option of saying they for these people, or being even more progressive with transgender people in ways that were unheard of at the time. And that's not where she went with the story. She had some very, very binary ideas of gender described in this book. And the main character, Jen Li Ai, is very strongly identified as a man and said very sexist things as a Terran in ways that I definitely struggled with.
I changed my mind. I'll try to deliver my speech, my brief speech, in English so that my colleagues can both follow me. But se c'è qualcuno di voi che non capisce, lo dica. If someone doesn't understand, please tell me. Okay. These are precisely the reasons for which I rejected the novel when I read it in the 70s. Very early 70s, because this novel was immediately translated into Italian in 71 or 72, I think, in a beautiful hardcover edition, beautifully translated, and so on. But I was then a very boyish or young adult reader of science fiction who had always read stories written by men or by women that posed like men, for example, C.L. Moore, Lake Brackett, and others. So my idea of the genre referred to male stereotypes, which I frankly loved, and maybe still love, because I must confess that I never fully embraced the feminist ideology in toto, in all. I know that today in the United States, 45 or almost 50 years later, 45 years later, many things have changed. In the United States today, you can't even say things like, I'm telling freely now to you, not to mention the race problem, which is a very real, serious problem. But anyway, back then, I was a 20 years old reader of science fiction. I'd always read authors like Asimov, Silverberg, or Damon Knight, Robert Sheckley, Frederick Brown, Jack Williamson, you name it. When I first read this novel, I was in a train, and I was so outraged by the book that I wanted to throw it out of the window. I didn't, because it was an hardcover and could kill someone. But it was a psychological problem which presented itself a second time when, for reason of work, because then I had become an assistant editor at Robot Magazine, I was forced to read the stories by James Tiptree Jr., another champion of feminist science fiction. But my opinion, my objections, are not political at all. They are purely psychological. When I read the Tiptree story, Houston, Houston, Do You Read?, I was more than outraged. I was completely I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe my eyes reading the story that someone could speak so harshly of men. In a way, this was exactly what women experienced and felt for most of the time. But even men can feel that. So I decided to never read James Tiptree anymore. And to this day, it is a shock for me even to say her name. Now, try not to be shocked. I am speaking with complete confidence in your understanding, human other than academical or political. Even with Ursula Le Guin, the same thing has happened, in the sense that I was never able to read anything more of hers. But stay tranquil, stay calm, because other writers have had this effect on me. For example, in the mystery genre, which I love, Cornel Woolrich was one of these. He was so horrible in some of his novels, for example, Black Calliope or The Bride Wore Black, and so on, that I couldn't go on. Even if I love him and I have a complete set of his novels, I decided not to go on because it was like reading death happening before of you.
So I think that the great thing about science fiction today is that we have so many options for what to read. We can follow an author throughout their career, and there's so much science fiction that it's easier to say, oh, well, I'm a science fiction fan, and not read, for example, women who write science fiction. But I think that is a political decision on your part, and saying that it's not about feminism is... I will fight you on that. I also have some sympathy in discovering an author that doesn't appeal to you at all for a potentially superficial reason. I will refuse to read any Asimov. I have never read, and I will never read, Asimov.
Now, why so?
Because Asimov, my first exposure to who Asimov is, was as a convention runner when I was warned that, oh, you know, that guest of honor, we need to be careful of them because they're kind of like an Asimov. And I said, what's that? What does that mean? I've heard of Asimov, but I don't know what you mean by that. And the other convention runner said, well, Isaac Asimov, when he was alive, used to request conventions to assign him a teenage girl to sit on his lap during the convention. And that horrified me. And I decided I did not need to read anyone whose writing was based in such a sexist idea of a teenage woman should be assigned to him to sit in his lap.
So we share the same kind of emotion or feeling. I think we share it, yes.
Maybe.
I don't.
Eight
I don't know.
Left.
Yeah. So the one thing is maybe if we could, if someone in the audience has something to say, and then we wrap it up.
So I brought a book to give to the person who asks the first question at this panel. This is a book of translated science fiction from China into English. So if you would like to ask us a question, you get a reward. Yes.
First of all, thanks for Pana. And in general, she was an literate person and a wonderful author and a wonderful person. So this is what makes her a complete...
What made Le Guin a complete person, not... Also, the writing was fantastic. When you mentioned that you separate, because sometimes you get all of it, the person and the writer. In the cases that you were mentioning, you separate and you maybe drop both of them because you don't like the person and the writer. This happens also for the actors or wrestlers, but the list is endless. So the question is, how has Ursula Le Guin influenced you, all of you, or each of you, not as a writer, but as a person? Wait, because
it's so noisy outside that I don't, I can't thank you, but give me back the question. Thanks.
Enjoy it.
I will.
So, I think you have the most personal experience of Ursula.
Okay, I think any kind of reaction is legitimate, is okay when it comes to the person. Everyone is entitled not to like someone. I mean, Le Guin is definitely both sides that were appealing. She was both a very pleasant person and a writer. I would love, among other things, she had, at some point, her correspondence with, talking about James Tipperary, was published. And there, these two writers were so completely different, both in their writings and in their biographies, where would share over many years, obviously something very, very strong. Is there someone right now I would react the opposite way? Would I have the same reaction had someone told me about Asimov? Probably, I think so. I know that there have been similar things about a lot of other people, and I know that I have never read anything about, I don't know, Randall Garrett or Marion Zimmer Bradley or and now Forrest J. I'm not going to read anything by Ackerman. That's me. I'm going to say this is my gut feeling. Might there be exceptions? I think so. There might be.
Well, so the interesting thing is the story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, right, is about the ethics of, you know, is it okay for one to suffer so that many can have a better life or better experiences? And that might be applicable to this question as well, is if you think about it, the person who is the artist or the actor or the author or the illustrator is impacting the world around them, not just with the story they tell or the world that they create, but also with their personal decisions. And so one of the things that I love about Ursula K. Le Guin is that I don't know anything bad about her. I think that The Left Hand of Darkness could have been a more progressive and more feminist work, but I think that the body of work that Ursula K. Le Guin produced was overall very progressive and feminist, and I appreciate that she moved the needle on people's expectations about science fiction and the thinking about gender, even in some of the works which don't go as far as I would have liked, the thinking about gender was moved in terms of the consciousness of the genre based on her work. And so it impacted me personally when I read it in college, and it continues to have ripple effects. But I think it also is the case that Ursula K. Le Guin's work impacted the genre in general.
Well, I understand the very different points of view. Probably I was even losing at the time my former interest in science fiction as a whole. And I understood then, back then, that science fiction was no more homogeneous genre, but an ensemble, more or less, of different voices, different perspectives, reflecting the American cultural scene. But I didn't live in America. I lived in Europe, where feminism was still backwards at the time. And anyway, I feel that the time was no more time of great science fiction projections forward. The last one was probably 2001, Space Odyssey. After that, Earth and its problems became the main object in science fiction, and so is today. Even the masterpieces of science fiction cinema, like Blade Runner or others, are preoccupied with the future of the Earth. I personally am not. It's probably a blind spot in my mind, in my vision, in my soul, one could say. Because I continue loving the events, so to speak, which had brought me to science fiction in the first instance, with an Isaac Asimov story novel, the first novel of the Foundation series, which at the time I found horribly complicated, and I waited 7 years before completing it. But it sold me the genre as a grandiose view of the universe, a universe made for men, I admit that. But I'm not no John Milius, no. No, it's different. Or maybe I am a gent.
So,
9 seconds.
Yeah, I was going to say we have 9 seconds, we might want to just wrap it up and talk at lunch.
So I was curious about specifically what sort of problems in translation did you encounter? I say this as someone who speaks English a little bit of Italian, so that's very interesting.
There were a few.
So is it now time for lunch?
No,
there's another panel. Yes, okay, so we need to give over the room to the next panel. But during lunch, we will all be available to talk.
And so, tomorrow morning.
Yes. Thank you everyone for coming.
Thank you.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificas.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificas.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. L'autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Blocco 1, pronto. Blocco 1, posizionato.
Potenza erogata, 23%. Così.
Blocco 2, è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2, posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Allarme rosso, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Chiudete l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigatevi!
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì.
Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 è pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 posizionato.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.